Afternoon, Brett Johnson with you on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on a Thursday. Also joined by Eric in the production booth. Eric, it's been a long time since I've done a live Thursday show. Kind of throwing me off here of my routine, but glad to be live in studio. How you doing in there, Eric?
I'm doing all right. Been a slow day, kind of.
Yeah, slow days aren't the worst thing in the world. Yeah, exactly. Hey, big thanks to everyone who attended our Politics and Impeachment Forum last night at Hamline University. Good conversation with Professor David Schultz, and we'll talk a little bit more about that coming up later on in the show. But first, I want to go back to a topic that we covered a little bit earlier this week. And this is something the Star Tribune put out, I believe it was Sunday, talking about how a number of local cities, and this is a big increase over the past few years, are asking the legislature to have an increase in their local sales tax. Now, on the surface, you might think, well, this sounds about like the most boring topic you could possibly cover. But this actually does have a very direct impact on your pocketbook, since we've seen, I think it was this past year, 18 individual cities going to the state legislature and asking for an increase in their sales tax. And again, as I said, something that might not necessarily catch your attention until you go to the grocery store or any other retail establishment and notice that maybe your bill is a little bit higher than you expect. So joining us now on the program to talk about why a number of cities are doing this is Gary Carlson. He is the Intergovernmental Relations Director for the League of Minnesota Cities, and they are at lmc.org, and Gary is with us now. Hey, how are you doing today, Gary?
Good, Brett. Thanks for inviting me today.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we kind of dive into this topic and talk about why cities have been asking for these increases in sales taxes, can you tell us exactly what the League of Minnesota Cities is and what you guys do?
Yeah, the League of Minnesota Cities was actually formed in 1913, and we basically are an association of cities across the state of Minnesota. There are 853 cities in the state, and 833 are members of the League, and we provide a variety of services ranging from conferences and training to insurance services to basic legal advice, and we also provide legislative advocacy services on behalf of cities across the state.
So let's talk about this idea that a number of cities have been asking the state legislature to raise their sales tax, because I didn't even know that it was a process that local cities actually have to get approval from the state before they can raise their sales taxes. So can you talk about that process, about what cities have to do to get that approval from the legislature, what goes into the process, and generally, are their requests approved?
Yeah. Well, and let me step back just briefly in time, because back in, I believe it was in the mid-1970s, the legislature enacted a law that basically prohibited cities and counties from enacting a tax on sales or income. And so that was done at a time when it was close to the time that we adopted the set of tax policy changes known as the Minnesota Miracle. It was done because the legislature decided at that time that they were going to raise more of the tax dollars at the state level and then share some of that money back with local units of government, including cities, counties, and school districts. But since then, a number of cities have asked the legislature for special dispensation, the authorization to impose a sales tax. And I think there are roughly about 45 cities right now and about the same number of counties that actually impose a local sales tax on sales within their jurisdiction. And so the process generally has required, or up to this point has required, that a city come forward by having the council adopt a resolution supporting a sales tax was step number one. Step number two, the jurisdiction would have to go to the voters and receive voter approval. And then the third and final step was the city or county would have to come to the legislature and seek special legislation that would say that they have the authority to impose that sales tax. Now, that process was changed last year to reverse those last two steps. So now a city adopts a resolution, a city council adopts a resolution, and then they must then come to the legislature and present their case to the legislature as to what they want to fund and why they need to fund it. And then finally, if the legislature says yes, then they would have to go to the voters. The voters would have the ability to either approve or deny that local sales tax. So that's kind of how the process works in Minnesota at the current point.
So let's talk about why a number of cities are doing this, because as I specifically look at the numbers right here, in some years it's been maybe 5, 6, or 7 cities that have been asking for this, or even during a period of the late 2000s, no cities were asking for this. Then all of a sudden we hit 2019 and we had nearly 20 cities asking for an increase in their local sales tax. So what's kind of the reasoning why we're doing this? Is this because maybe we have local governments that don't want to raise their property taxes? Is it a cut and local government aid? Can you talk a little bit about that, about why you think we are seeing cities kind of going by this avenue to raise revenue?
Well, I would speculate that it's really a combination of factors. You've hit upon several of those. You know, the local government aid program that has been the main source of shared revenues from the state of Minnesota is just now being restored. It will be restored in 2021 to the level it was last funded at in 2002. So nearly 20 years after a series of deep cuts in that program, it is only back to the actual number of dollars appropriated to that program, you know, basically, 18 years ago. So that source of revenue has not grown. I know the other factor that I hear regularly is that our property taxes are getting high, and we really are having trouble raising taxes more from our local property taxpayers. And then thirdly, I think there's a little bit more science involved in perhaps trying to determine who is receiving the benefits from certain public investments, and if there's a better way to finance a project to acknowledge, without getting into economic terms, but spillover effects, where somebody that is not a resident, not a taxpayer, benefits from a property. And so cities are looking and saying, does this project have benefits beyond our borders, beyond our geographic constituency, and should we be tapping a source of revenue that may effectively help pay for that particular facility with taxes generated by non-residents? And that's really where the sales tax comes into the equation, because in many instances, retail hubs or cities that are home to retail sales are servicing citizens that come in from surrounding areas that may not necessarily live and pay taxes in those jurisdictions.
Right, and that was an argument I was making on Monday on why I can see why a city would want to do this, because if you have, for lack of a better way of putting it, a tourist attraction, yeah, why not maybe put a little bit of a tax on there to raise revenue from your own community? And as you brought up, you could have people from outside the city that certainly benefit from that.
Right.
So what sorts of projects are these sales tax increases using to fund? Are there restrictions that they have to be used for X project or anything like that?
Well, the legislature in Minnesota has traditionally only allowed a local sales tax to be used for a capital project. So when I say capital project, generally referring to things like libraries, civic centers, ice arenas, public safety facilities, maybe like a police station or a fire station, certain park and rec facilities. Those have been kind of the traditional uses. The Minnesota legislature has not allowed a city to impose a sales tax for general city operations. There is one exception to that rule, and that is the city of Duluth, which coincidentally had the very first sales tax way back, I believe, in the late 1970s. But other than Duluth, the only uses are for generally capital projects, so bricks and mortar projects. This year the legislature did tie in a specific requirement that a city would have to demonstrate what they term as regional significance. And regional significance is just that the benefits of that facility accrue to those necessarily beyond the boundaries of that individual city.
Couple more final questions for you here, Gary. We've seen kind of an interesting coalition of legislatures who are opposed to this idea of allowing cities to raise their sales tax, both DFLers and Republicans, that especially come from rural areas that say this kind of unfairly benefits communities that actually do have large retail centers. So can you talk a little bit about that and maybe what your thoughts are on some of this opposition and maybe some changes the legislature might be doing in terms of how cities can raise their sales taxes?
You know, that's a good point. It isn't a partisan issue necessarily, right? Even though it involves taxes, there have been those that oppose the sales tax because of equity concerns. And when I refer to equity, I'm suggesting that a city that does not have much of a retail base, maybe more of a bedroom community or a small greater Minnesota community that is comprised largely of residences, would not be able to generate revenue from a sales tax because they don't have the retail sales going on, whereas the larger communities that have the shopping malls or the retail facilities would be more able to tap that. You know, one of the countervailing comments that I always have is that, well, the bigger, say, for example, a greater Minnesota regional center city has probably a lot of people coming in to shop and recreate and work in those regional centers. And, you know, you could argue that those individuals are creating a bit of an overburden for the city because they're not necessarily taxpayers. And so there's a good debate that goes on at the Capitol every year looking at these sales taxes, looking at issues like equity. The legislature has in recent years authorized sales taxes for some relatively small communities with longer time frames for their sales tax to finance various improvements. But that will be an ongoing debate at the Capitol, there is no doubt, and it does tie into other issues like the revenue-sharing programs like local government aid, which do help cities that have weaker tax bases relative to those that have stronger tax bases.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see in future sessions if we do end up seeing a change from the state legislature. We've been speaking with Gary Carlson. He is the Intergovernmental Relations Director for the League of Minnesota Cities, talking about why so many cities around Minnesota are asking for increases in their sales tax. Hey, Gary, thanks so much for joining us on the program today and filling us in on some information on that topic.
You bet, Brett. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Thanks again, Gary. So as I was saying, yeah, not the sexiest topic, but it is something that absolutely directly impacts your pocketbook because who knows, maybe you live in a city that will be going to the state legislature and asking to raise your taxes because in a way it kind of is a workaround around those property taxes. We have more on the way here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson, including following up and kind of giving you a recap of what we covered at last night's political and impeachment forum with Professor David Schultz. That's on the way next.
Tom Hartman here, letting you know how you can go solar with All Energy Solar, even way up north in Minnesota. Lots of people ask them, isn't Minnesota too cloudy for solar? No. The truth? For one thing, Minneapolis gets nearly as much sun each year as Houston, Texas. But it isn't just about how much sun you get. It's also about having access to great local incentive programs that make solar affordable. Learn what your options are to save with solar and visit allenergysolar.com today.
This is Chad, owner of AM950. I've been telling you about my friends at Snap Construction, who are arguably the most well-reviewed exterior construction company in the metro. Don't just take my word for it. Take a look at all their reviews online. Winter is the most cost-effective time of the year to complete your construction project. A majority of Minnesotans choose to have their work completed on their home in the summer when they should be enjoying the weather. As a result, the demand for labor in the summer is much higher. The most cost-effective way to improve or restore your home is in the winter due to the lower demand. Right now, Snap Construction is offering an additional 30% off of labor to the AM950 listeners on your next construction project between now and the end of February. Call 612-333-SNAP and mention AM950 for an additional 30% off. As always, Snap Construction stands by their work with a lifetime craftsmanship warranty. Don't wait to get a free estimate by calling 612-333-SNAP or find them online at snapconstruction.com. Financing options available.
Hi, I'm Frank Brown, owner of the only minority-owned union print shop in Minnesota.
Do you work with political campaigns?
Yes, we have years of experience helping campaigns.
Do you print buttons for political campaigns?
Yes, we print everything.
Do you print rally signs?
Yes, we print everything.
Do you print T-shirts?
Yes, we print everything. Choose the only minority-owned union print shop in Minnesota for all your political campaign needs. Learn more at mpuptown.com. Minuteman Press Uptown. We print everything.
What kind of a jackass would let an animal pick their insurance? Did you really think a lizard could save you money on car insurance? Would you let a duck pick your health policy? Insurance can be a zoo, but this is ridiculous. What you really need is an insurance agent that isn't looking out for the insurance companies. You need Cheryl at Array, an independent agent with 30 years' experience looking for the best rate possible. Quit monkeying around and call 763-504-3067. That's 763-504-3067 for Cheryl at Array, representing you, not the insurance companies.
Turn to Auto Technical with your vehicle donation. Even though Auto Technical is a small nonprofit, we have helped more families with transportation than any organization in Minnesota. Since 94, we have reconditioned donated vehicles so they have a higher tax benefit. Call Richard at 612-919-5526. 612-919-5526 or autotech.org.
You're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. I am indeed live on this Thursday afternoon. I know in the past I've normally been pre-recorded on these Thursdays, but with FYI Politics now airing at 2 o'clock, you'll be able to catch me live just about every day of the week, so definitely happy about that. So before I dive into what we talked about last night at our political and impeachment forum, I have a couple of national headlines to go over, and the political theater continues with the impeachment trial where Alan Dershowitz, one of Trump's defense attorneys at the Senate impeachment trial, made a pretty horrible argument that even Republicans are coming out against, where he said that, well, it's okay to bribe a foreign country as long as you're doing it to secure your own country and your own reelection is within the national interest of your own country, which is an absurd argument that even Republicans were coming out against. Now, apparently, he's been tweeting and saying, well, people were misconstruing what I was saying, but gotta love that political theater where he said, yeah, well, it's okay to bribe someone as long as it's in the national interest of the country.
Yeah, Dershowitz has some great arguments.
I love Dershowitz and Ken Starr.
You know, I don't even like massages.
Yeah. Dershowitz and Ken Starr and some of the other clowns that are out there. Hey, also, we have some red state Democrats that are wavering somewhat on impeachment, three of them to be exact. One I can understand, but the other two, I'm not sure why they are necessarily fretting over this vote, so let's run through these three. Doug Jones, senator from Alabama. Joe Manchin, everyone's favorite Democrat, maybe outside of Colin Peterson from West Virginia. Then you have Kyrsten Sinema, who another favorite among a lot of Democrats. She also has been wavering on how she'll end up voting on whether to acquit or also convict Donald Trump. So on the Doug Jones scenario, I can get where he's coming from, being that he is facing a very tough reelection campaign this fall. Although some polling data shows he actually has a much better chance than I thought. There was one recent poll that showed he was only down by 3 points to Jeff Sessions, who is seeking, of course, his old Senate seat after serving as Trump's attorney general. But 3 points is actually a much tighter margin than I thought that would be, considering how popular Sessions is in Alabama. So at least some good news there. But at least in the case of Doug Jones, though, I can get why he would waver on impeachment, being that Trump is popular in Alabama. And to play into that political theater term that I was using, yeah, you might actually have to vote to acquit the president. But the other two, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Those two I can't understand for the life of me. For this reason, both of them were, well, in the case of Sinema, she was first elected in 2018, while Joe Manchin was reelected in 2018. So what does that mean? They're not facing reelection again until 2024. And Eric, I would think you would agree with this too. We don't have long-term memories when it comes to politics in this country. When it comes to 2024 and Manchin and Sinema are facing re-election, I don't think anyone's going to care about how they voted on impeachment. That is going to be so far in the past, being that that's over 4 years away, that I think they're overthinking this.
Absolutely, yeah. Because like this is going to come up in their, you know, in a, some sort of campaign ad, you know, far in the future. Maybe they'd replay these events, but outside of that, it's never going to happen. People have like a one news cycle memory.
Right. It's that, and, well, there's two scenarios that will happen when Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are running for re-election in 2024. Either they will be coming off the second term of President Donald Trump, and if you just look at the history of two-term presidents, they generally aren't very popular, especially with Republicans, when they're at the end of their second term. So at that point, Trump would probably be even more unpopular than he already is. And then I think you combine that with the fact that we're very likely to experience a recession, if not this year, at least at some point during whatever the next presidential term might be, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican serving. And that's not really a partisan issue. I just think we have an absolute debt bubble for both corporations and individuals that is going to burst at some point, and whoever is in the White House is going to take the blame for that. So that's scenario one, where they're going to be facing re-election off of what will likely be a very unpopular President Donald Trump after two terms. The other scenario is you have a Democrat, whether that's a Joe Biden or a Bernie Sanders, seeking re-election. And at that point, no one's going to remember Donald Trump of 2020 in the future in 2024. I mean, think back to 2012 with Barack Obama versus Mitt Romney. No one was really talking about John McCain or George W. Bush during that campaign. So overall, I think you have Manchin and Sinema overthinking their votes coming up here. But at least for Doug Jones, I can kind of buy his argument. But I could also see the fact that it's probably not going to sway many people in that state of Alabama, because people are so dug into their positions that a vote either to convict or acquit Donald Trump probably won't have much of an impact on the re-election chances of Doug Jones. And that moves on to something and kind of brings us to a point that I wanted to highlight that Professor Schultz talked about last night at our Politics and Impeachment Forum, which, by the way, we will be playing back audio from that forum on future programs. And I thought he had a great analogy on how divided the country is, and to explain how people have moved into left and to right camps. He brought up that over history, typically, if you were looking at how people and their political leanings were on the political spectrum, it looked like a bell curve, where if you had people on the left and people on the right, those were relatively small percentages, while in the middle you had a big spike of so-called moderates and people who would either vote Democrat or Republican. But then David actually used, I think, this really solid analogy where he said, over the past 20 years or so, someone basically just stomped their foot on the tip of that bell curve and drove people either more to be ingrained with the Democratic Party or more ingrained with the Republican Party. His analogy is that it essentially looks like a camel hump, which I thought was kind of a funny analogy, but actually fitting. That's typically how, and I think that actually is how, the political spectrum looks right now, where you have a large swath of people who typically vote Democrat, a large swath of people on the right who typically vote Republican, and you have still a few people that are still moderates that might kind of waver on how they vote in every election. But that number of people has dropped dramatically over the past 10 to 20 years. Now, there are some arguments you can make about, well, this new so-called Democratic coalition is the center of that new Democratic coalition as extreme as the center of the new Republican coalition. And I would argue that the center of that Republican coalition, or the center of that little right hump on that camel, is much further to the right than the Democrats are to the left. But he brought up the interesting point that if you're sitting there and campaigning as a presidential candidate, is it really advantageous to go and try to capture people who are still sitting there in the middle of those two camel humps, going by that analogy? Because, well, there's not many people there anymore. And oftentimes you even see Democrats even trying to reach and campaign and try to coerce people that are already on that Republican side to vote for them, which almost never works. So I thought he actually made a pretty compelling argument on why, for the most part, in today's modern political environment, you're better off trying to get people to turn out among your own base, because you have people who are ingrained on the Democratic side and are ingrained on the Republican side. And the only way I would expand on what he was saying is that just because people are sitting on that Democratic side, that big hump or of the camel, and then the right side of the hump of the Republican side of that camel, if you're kind of following along
so
with David's
analogy. We're talking a Bactrian camel, not a dromedary.
Something like that. We'll roll with that. The only thing I would add for that is that the people who are on the left side are guaranteed to never vote for someone on the right, and the people on the right are never guaranteed to vote for someone on the left. But the challenge is that just because someone is sitting on the left side or the right side does not mean they're actually going to vote for their own candidate. And I think that's kind of the argument we were talking about last night about how generally presidential candidates are probably better off actually trying to campaign with people that are among their own base that might not actually turn out to vote. We're at 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. So we'll play back some audio from that forum, but I kind of got a kick out of that analogy he was bringing up. Let's go to Gary in Minneapolis, who is hanging on the phone lines. Hey there, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Yeah. It's just the irony of these darn Republicans. I had it on for a while today, and one of them, when they're making that impeachment, they said, why would you also elect the best economy in 30 or 50 years, the lowest unemployment, minorities never did so great in the history of the country, and on. The health care is better. Prescription drug prices are down, people's incomes are going up, and he went on and on with that crap. If it's so good, how come homelessness is way up? And then he even said the less people getting government assistance. That's because they cut government assistance. He just cut the SNAP or food stamps for a lot of people. He wants to cut more of it for women with kids and stuff. And they said single women never had so good. It's like a different universe. And remind me of one thing before I sign off. Joseph Goebbels, propaganda minister, Hitler said, repeat a lie enough, people believe it. And that's what's going on in this country with Fox News and the hate radio and the rest of these damn Republicans.
All right, thanks for the call there, Gary. As
fired
usual,
up.
I was going to say, as usual, calm, cool, and collected, Gary in Minneapolis.
But he's right. I mean, just because they can point to a handful of metrics doesn't mean that things are going well.
Oh, you know? Stats can absolutely lie.
Because life expectancy is going down. Diseases of despair are going up.
My favorite one is when they always say, look at black unemployment.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you actually have to take a deeper look at that number. And, well, are those jobs that they're getting
actually
paid?
We've all got five jobs. We've got so many jobs.
We've got so many jobs. I drive for Uber and I'm a greeter at Walmart. Aren't I doing great?
7 hours a week, but I have five jobs.
Mm-hmm. And technically, the way you actually measure unemployment is that, yeah, those people are classified as being employed. So, yeah, when you look through about whether people are employed or whether they are actually making enough income to make a living, well, those are two entirely different aspects. We'll continue with more news coming up in just a few minutes, but let's get to 2020 Talks from Public News Service.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
Yang is my first preference, but I'm in a small precinct with only three delegates. There's a very strong possibility that Yang won't be in the top three, and I'm leaning towards either Warren or Buttigieg as my second preference. Haven't decided that yet.
Iowan Phil Engen's quandary echoes the rest of Iowa caucusgoers. With days to go, voters in some campaigns are strategizing about the second and final round of voting. Who to support if your candidate doesn't reach the minimum threshold of 15%? Multiple campaigns have approached businessman Andrew Yang. While not endorsing anyone, he said, quote, many of my supporters would naturally head to Bernie, unquote, at a Bloomberg News breakfast. The top concern among Democrats is clear, voiced by retired art teacher Ron Dinsdale of Des Moines.
I just know I'm going to support whoever gets the nomination because we have got to get rid of Trump.
And fear that their favorite may not be able to defeat the incumbent. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is calling for, quote, courage over cynicism, unquote, and some big Democratic donors are afraid Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders could actually get nominated. Yesterday's Super PAC Democratic Majority for Israel launched the first negative ad campaign explicitly attacking Sanders, saying he can't win in November. Moderate Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar's campaign strategy is modeled on Kentucky and Louisiana, states that went for Trump in 2016 but elected Democratic governors last year.
That was a coalition of fired up Democrats and moderate Republicans and independents.
Retired minister and veteran Russell Melby also wants a moderate. He's for former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
And it's important to me that he's a liberal. It's also important to me that he's not someone who will likely only support somebody who's on the far left of the political spectrum. And in my judgment, that's a recipe for our losing.
Or not, as Sanders raised over $1 million in the aftermath of the attack ad. Rather than swing voters, Sanders is looking to brand new voters. He predicts if the turnout is high, he'll win.
So the question is, can we bring out people who do not always come out to vote? Working people who are often discouraged with the political process, young people who have not really gotten involved in the political process.
Speaking of turnout, the Iowa Democratic Party announced a partnership with the Iowa GOP and Des Moines Regional Transit Authority to provide free public transit to caucus-goers of any age or ability in central Iowa. Here's Catherine Crist, chair of the Iowa Democrats Disability Caucus.
When we make access more easy for people with disabilities, we automatically make that access available for everybody, even people without disabilities.
President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence are in Iowa today. Trump for a Des Moines rally, Pence for an Evangelicals for Trump event in Sioux City. They plan to flood the state with supporters on caucus day. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Located just south of downtown Minneapolis, the Blaisdell is the perfect venue for your next event. The Blaisdell is a fresh, modern, newly remodeled historic mansion with spaces that can accommodate groups of 25 to 700. While perfect for weddings, the Blaisdell also includes rooms with high-tech audio and video equipment for your company's next gathering. So whether it's a dream wedding or impressing colleagues and clients, choose the Blaisdell as your next event venue. Select dates are still available. More at theblaisdell.com.
This President's Day weekend, bring your family to the Osprey Wilds Environmental Learning Center, formerly known as the Audubon Center of the North Woods, on Grindstone Lake in Sandstone. The all-inclusive family weekend has locally sourced meals and winter activities like ice climbing, wildlife programming, skiing, and much more. Reserve your spot at OspreyWilds.org or call 320-245-2648. Osprey Wilds. Experience your environment.
With your AM 950 weather, this is Eric Nelson. Today, a chance of freezing rain after 3 p.m. with a high of 27 and a low of 25 tonight. Friday, the snow continues with a high of 34 and a low of 26, while Saturday will be sunny with a high of 37 and a low of 31. The 2020 Blue State Ball is right around the corner, and this year we're doing things a little differently. Less formal ball and more fun beer bash, taking place Sunday, February 23rd at the Bauhaus Brew Labs in Minneapolis. Come celebrate beating Trump and 15 years of AM 950. Get your tickets now at am950radio.com.
You're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on your Thursday afternoon. So I just learned of a term that I kind of got a kick out of after reading this article in The Intercept. It's called the Video Surveillance Industrial Complex. As they are talking about in this article that was written in The Intercept, how a number of private security cameras are actually getting plugged into police networks, so police have access and other authorities have access to be able to, well, watch for crime. And it's kind of an ingenious way that they're doing this, because originally, if you were going to have a city install a bunch of security cameras, that's a huge amount of expense that a city would have to pay. But what if you set up a system where you can have a bunch of private cameras from private businesses or private homes connected to a police network, where if you set up your own closed-circuit TV camera, you can go ahead and plug it in your police network, and in exchange, they'll go ahead and watch security for you. So that's happened over the past few years, but something even more terrifying is happening that was brought up in this Intercept article. And that's the fact that they're getting to the point with these things that they not only do facial recognition, but they can actually predict behavior, which is just nuts. They have these capabilities that can detect fight detection, emotion recognition. Are you kidding me? Emotion recognition? Fall detection, loitering, dog walking, jaywalking, toll fare evasion, and even lie detection. So I hope you're paying attention to this, because this is kind of terrifying. If I can actually have a camera monitor me and actually detect my emotion, isn't that a little scary to think about in there, Eric, that you have software that now has the capability to not only recognize your face, but predict maybe if you're going to be able to commit a crime, or if you're in a bad emotional state, oh, we better monitor this person because he or she is more likely to go and, I don't know, rob something, or maybe do something at least a lesser degree like jaywalk or run a stoplight or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I've had thoughts about this too in, you know, like private companies. You know, let's say you're in a Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
They definitely look at your face. They have those monitors and stuff. So I'm just wondering how long it'll be till they recognize you by name. Hey, I haven't been here in a week. When's the last time you bought some toilet paper? ooh, he's walking kind of strangely. That looks like a shoplifter's gait.
Mm-hmm. And the way you can sell that to the public is by saying something like, oh, well, last time you were in Walmart, you bought so-and-so food. You bought...
Your Alexa lets you know that you have...
Do you want to buy this again? We'll even have someone go shop for you.
We've got our cat litter on sale.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. The only way I think you can get pushback against this and at least more outcry from the public is something that happened in Des Moines last year that I was reading about, and that's that they actually had these traffic cameras that were installed at different stoplights, and they caught literally everything and were fining people a whole lot of money. And of course, once you start
how many crimes they do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, once you actually started hitting people in their pocketbook, then all of a sudden the folks in Des Moines started to get a little more concerned about that. In fact, the city of Des Moines actually removed a number of these cameras. But I, for one, thought we were going to be like maybe 20 or 30 years away from this, but it's amazing how fast the technology actually evolves, because I want to bring up an example from the broadcast world that I work in. So as I've brought up on previous shows, I'm not sure if I've done it on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson yet, though, but as a side gig, I do professional live streaming of hockey games, football games, even a little bit of pro wrestling, where I bring out a bunch of broadcast equipment, whether that's a streaming computer, a number of cameras, headsets for the announcers. I'm the guy that brings all of that equipment out there. Now, about 5 or 6 years ago, I was having a chat with my business partner at the time, and we were talking about how sometimes it's actually really hard to find camera operators at these games. And my business partner, Kevin, was saying, well, why don't we just come up with some sort of system where you can have a camera that can somehow auto-detect, like, where the puck moves or where the ball moves on a basketball court? And at the time, I laughed at him and said, that's the stupidest idea that I've ever heard of in my life. We don't have the funding to come up with this idea, and it's probably a good 20 or 30 years away from happening. Fast forward to today, and this is something that's kind of putting me a little bit out of business in terms of streaming high school hockey games, is that there's probably a good 30 to 40% of hockey rinks around Minnesota that actually have these devices that are shaped, they're about the size of a soccer ball. And now you know how a soccer ball looks, where you have those different spots on a soccer ball. So these giant cameras, or these giant orbs, I guess we'll call them, on each of those spots you would have on a soccer ball, it's a different camera on each one of these. And somehow in these automated systems, they know which camera to focus on in the action when they're watching a sporting event, so you can essentially have an automated camera at every sporting event at a hockey rink, which is just nuts to think about. And I'm sitting here going, my business partner Kevin might have been onto something 5 or 6 years ago. In fact, they're actually at the point now where they can even plug in and keep score of the game, which I have no idea how that technology works. Yeah, they can even put up their own little scoreboard on the
especially when things get like overturned by refs or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not quite to that point, but they can come up with their own automated scoreboard. It can automatically stream these events to YouTube with no humans involved whatsoever. I'm just waiting for the point where they're actually going to have automated announcers.
Yeah.
Like play-by-play announcers for broadcast. That, I think, is
actually... We just need automated players.
Yeah. Yeah, why actually watch the action? We could just have automated everything and
set up a computer to watch it, too.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of funny sometimes that you can kind of dismiss Andrew Yang's candidacy, but he is onto something there talking about the level of automation in our society. Not saying whether his idea of having a universal basic income is the best solution to the problem, but he at least is emphasizing the problem.
There will have to be a solution.
Mm-hmm. Well, there has to be, sure. I mean, as I was saying, I thought this capability of having an automated camera and a complete automated broadcast of even a lower-level event like high school hockey, of all things, can actually be automated by these hockey rinks around town. There's a number of facilities that do this where if you talk to a rink in St. Louis Park or Minnetonka, they'll pay $10,000 or $12,000, but it's a one-time expense. Those cameras are set up, and boom, they're able to stream every single event that actually comes through to their rink. And yeah, it's amazing how much technology can evolve, and then the fact that, going back to what I was originally talking about, you can now plug in these private cameras into a police network. So that certainly makes you feel good, doesn't it? We're at 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Bernie Sanders just got the endorsement of a very powerful union as the Postal Workers Union, which represents about 200,000 workers, ended up endorsing him. And for the workers, I can't blame them because Bernie Sanders is one of the few candidates that is actually talking about, well, the following thing that happened back in 2006. So back when the House of Representatives and the Senate was flipping from Republican to Democrat between 2006 and 2007, in this lame duck session, Republicans put through a bill that required the Postal Service to fund their pension liabilities like 40 years ahead of time. They were asking to fund pensions and health care costs of employees who had not even been born yet. And that's a reason why, well, it's pretty much the only reason why, the Postal Service has actually been in so much debt for years and years and years, and why when you hear, oh, well, the Postal Service is failing, well, it's actually not. It's the fact that they have this huge burden of having to fund pensions 40 years ahead of time when there's no other governmental agency, let alone private industry business, that has to face this requirement. And Sanders, to his credit, is one of the few people that's actually been talking about this, so not necessarily surprised to see the 200,000 members of the Postal Workers Union to side with Bernie Sanders, since someone's got to repeal that bill, because the Postal Service is something you don't often think about, but once it's gone, you are certainly going to miss it when you realize it's going to cost you $10 to mail an envelope somewhere. The Postal Service is very efficient, and just look at what happened in Ireland when they got rid of their Postal Service. All of a sudden, everything went private. People were in an uproar when they figured out how much money it would cost them to send a piece of mail somewhere, and they actually ended up having to go back and reinstate their government-run Postal Service. So
there are a lot of things that the Postal Service only does, too, like that you can't get through FedEx or UPS, like shipping animals. I know it's
It's federally insured. FedEx doesn't want to do that, UPS doesn't want to do that. And by the way, those two companies don't want to go to Embarrass or Babbitt, Minnesota.
Oh, yeah.
There's no money up there for them to actually deliver a package to some rural town that's occupied by only a few hundred people. No, they would just rather have the Postal Service do that. So, yeah, not surprised that they ended up actually endorsing the only candidate who's largely been highlighting that issue. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll come on back with a few more stories to wrap up FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on your Thursday afternoon.
My part-time service in the Army National Guard makes it possible for me to be more for the community I call home. I'm a better neighbor because my service has taught me how important it is to be a team player. My training helps me in my classes when I give attention to detail to the task at hand. My service in the Army National Guard allows me to keep my country safe from threats. Learn more about how you too can live and serve part-time by visiting NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Minnesota Army National Guard. Aired by the Minnesota Broadcasters Association and this station.
Better Futures Minnesota impacts the community by addressing root causes of poverty, homelessness, dependency on public assistance, and high rates of untreated trauma that often lead to incarceration. The lives of men served have been marked by chaos, violence, and loss, which contribute to feelings of devaluation, rage, and lost human potential. Healings from this trauma is essential before participants can succeed as workers, fathers, and responsible community members. Learn how you can support our efforts at BetterFuturesMinnesota.com.
Come experience Nightingale at 26th and Lindale in Minneapolis for mulled wine and delicious signature dishes from Chef Carrie and her team. Nightingale is perfect for special occasions with extensive wine, beer, and cocktail selections, along with their dedication to great service. Open every day till 2 a.m. with a full menu served until 1 a.m. and two award-winning happy hours daily. Plus, there's a weekend brunch at 10 a.m. Find more at NightingaleMPLS.com.
Connections Radio Show is all about tapping into our hardwired hunger to connect. We examine meaningful connections to ourselves, our community, and the world around us. By opening the door to innovative insights by a wide variety of interesting guests, we'll make the connections to something bigger than ourselves. Join me, Lori Fitz, your host of Connections Radio Show, and together we'll make the connections. Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Hey, I guess we found a new name for our show.
Really? What's the new name?
Pilots Progressive Party.
How did you ever come up with that?
Pilots our name and progressive fun is our game.
Well, what's that about?
It's a one-hour news show with progressive guests and information you normally don't hear on the radio.
Well, that's so exciting. I have a few ideas for guests myself.
I know they'll be progressive.
Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. on AM 950.
The Progressive Voice of Minnesota.
Next time on Philosophy Talk, the death of the sentence.
What are you talking about? I speak and write in full sentences all the time.
But don't you agree that emails, texts, and tweets encourage way too much informality in language?
LMAO, John. Shrug emoji.
Astonished face emoji. Angry face emoji.
Death of the sentence. Next time on Philosophy Talk.
Philosophy Talk. Every Sunday at 8 a.m. and again at 2 p.m. on AM 950.
You're back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on your Thursday afternoon. Oh, I wish the city of Minneapolis would have had this policy about 8 years ago. Apparently, Minneapolis police officers are no longer going to ticket motorists for broken headlights or turn signals, instead hounding out vouchers to pay for vehicle repairs under a new department policy that was unveiled yesterday. The only ticket I've had over the past 10 years was actually for a broken turn signal light. So not only could have I avoided a ticket, they actually would have given me a voucher to pay and get my light repaired. So wish I could go back in time and have that policy in place. Got Lawrence in St. Paul who's been hanging on the phone lines. Hey, Lawrence, how you doing today? It was good to see you last night over at Hamline University.
Yep, always good. Good form there. Hey, who's going to pay for those vouchers? I'm just curious.
That's actually a good question. Yeah, I'm guessing that's probably going to come out of, well, our pocketbooks if you happen to live in Minneapolis.
So you go break your headlight and I got to go pay for it. See, that's...
That's probably accurate. It doesn't say in this report I saw who actually is funding this, but essentially you are right. Yeah, where it's the community coming together and funding that. So, yeah, that must be a notice to everyone. Don't have your taillights out, otherwise our taxes go up.
Yeah, true. So if I see somebody with their taillight out, I'm going to take the law into my own hands, I would assume. Mm-hmm.
That's right. We're encouraging vigilante justice. That's a good point there, Lawrence.
Vigilante by fixing their headlights.
Yeah. It's like vigilante good Samaritanism or something. Yeah.
Hey, about last night. Here's the thing. I mean, you kind of summarized what happened there pretty good last night. And I kind of analyzed it further. You know, he made an analogy with the two camelbacks,
mm-hmm.
and I took that analogy further. And I did some basic research. Actually, I don't see a way. I'm just going to take it further and be honest with everybody out here. I don't see a way that the Democrats are going to win using the professor's analogy last night. And I think they're not going to win, and I'll tell you why. Because we are so partisan. That's what he said last night, and I agree with him 100%. But we're making two mistakes as Democrats. First of all, we're reaching over to that side instead of trying to firm up and motivate our own base.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect example, Amy Klobuchar and Cory Booker. They were perfect examples of us trying to reach out to them. No, we're reaching out to them. That's our first mistake. And our second mistake is we have no response, in my opinion, for what has become a religion. Trumpism has become a religion based on the white supremacy, and people don't want to lose their white privilege. I don't blame them. But if you want to win, you have to figure out a way to tell the white person, hey, look, don't worry about your privilege. Nothing is going to be taken away from you. But you also are not going to discriminate against other people. We're all going to be in this boat together. Now, if you don't like that, then, okay, we know what kind of person you are, and I will not seek your vote anymore. But there will be some people on the other side that say, you know what? Yeah, I voted for Trump because I'm afraid that I'm going to lose some of my status if I do not vote for him. That's how it's become a religion. And I'll say this, and I'll hang up. So the only way to beat Trump is you're going to have to dismantle his religion. And I don't see the Democrats doing that. And I see the Democrats even exacerbating this by trying to reach out to people
yes.
that will never vote for them.
Exactly.
All right.
Hey, Lawrence, good phone call. And yeah, that kind of expands on what I was talking about earlier in the show, where if you look at these two groups, or if you're using that camel analogy that Professor Schultz used last night, just because someone sitting in that left camp or someone sitting in that right camp does not guarantee that they are going to vote for their own candidate. The thing I think it does guarantee is that they won't vote for anyone on the other side. So that expands on what Lawrence was saying, is that if you're trying to reach out to someone who's in that group of right-wing voters, it's a guarantee they're not going to vote for you and cross over and say, well, maybe you made some reasonable arguments. That's never going to happen. So, yeah, I definitely agree with the point Lawrence was making right there.
And we had a call from David the Trucker, who was just calling to say that those turn light signal vouchers are not funded by the city.
Oh,
it's
really?
Actually funded through a separate charity, I guess.
Oh, through
lights,
a charity.
Lights okay. On, yeah.
Lights on, there we go. So, yeah, no reason for vigilante good Samaritanism. I like that term right there. Everyone's just going out and trying to fix each other's taillights. We should just keep giving out that propaganda, Eric, in terms of making the world a better place.
That'd be a good, holiday.
Like, yeah,
go out
exactly.
And instead of create mischief, just go do something aggressively nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Go fix everyone's taillights so your taxes don't go up, even though, as David the Trucker corrected, that's not actually the way it works. It apparently comes through a charity. Hey, one other correction that we just got a note about, and when I was talking about how the Postal Service actually had to fund their liabilities 40 years in advance, I was actually wrong. It's even worse than that. It's 75 years, which is even more insane than funding 40 years worth of pension liabilities. 75 years. Yeah. Could you picture any private business doing that or any governmental agency trying to say, oh, yeah, you have to fund all of these benefits 75 years in advance for employees who have not even been born yet?
Get it done in 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Get it done. And you got to get it done, in a certain amount of time. Otherwise, we're going to start closing a bunch of post offices. Yeah, exactly. And one final note that kind of made me laugh today. So remember how we're supposed to be building this indestructible wall, Eric, along the border? Well, it turns out there was a piece of border wall, I believe, in Arizona that actually got blown over by a gust of wind of only like 35 miles an hour. So I just love that. A 35-mile-an-hour wind gust ended up blowing down that section of wall, which no doubt there to anyone trying to cross the border wall, just get a bunch of fans and plug them in, and apparently, boom, you're going to be good to go to cross that border wall. Just got to run over to your local Target or Walmart. Well, I guess you probably don't really have Targets or Walmarts down on the border of Mexico, at least not ones that you probably want to go into. I'm guessing they are probably controlled by the cartels, unfortunately. All right, that's all the time we got for today on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Again, good to have a live Thursday show. Hopefully we'll be doing this much more often, where I'll be live about 5 days a week here on the program. Matt McNeil is coming up next, and don't forget, we still are airing Democracy Now! You still will be able to catch that every weekday from 4 until 5 o'clock. And make sure you order your Blue State Ball tickets. Those are going to sell out, and they're going fast. Get them now, am950radio.com. Blue State Ball coming up Sunday, February 23rd. At Bauhaus Brew Labs, am950radio.com.